We'd like to start by acknowledging that this episode was written and recorded in multiple locations across Australia. In the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of Wadawurrung Country, as well as the Gurungai and Gadigal peoples. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, and extend these respects to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today. This always was, and always will be, Aboriginal land.
Hi, welcome to Talking About a More Digital Government, a podcast by Code for Australia. My name's Esther, and I'm Code for Australia's Head of Community and Communications. I'm newish to the world of digital, and I'm super keen to learn as much as I can from our guests and our listeners.
And I'm Sean, Design Lead for Civic Makers, a tech-focused community initiative. I've worked within local government, as well as on tech teams looking from the outside in, and I'm endlessly curious about the ways tech can be leveraged for the public good. Throughout this podcast series, we're going to be asking big questions, highlighting cool innovations, and showcasing some of the incredible work that's happening in government departments and teams around Australia.
In our last episode of the year, we're going to be highlighting some amazing civic tech projects that have caught our attention. It's been an amazing time in civic tech. As a result of the pandemic, we've seen a huge rise in how technology, civic duty, and communication intersect, and we've also witnessed more people take creating and maintaining solutions into their own hands. This episode serves to highlight just a few of those amazing projects, and hopefully, the fantastic and innovative people that we speak with might inspire some of you to get activated, get involved, and get making. We'll be hearing from the folks at Design System AU, who are keeping the Australian Government Design System alive via a community initiative. We'll hear from Kenneth Tsang, creator of COVID Near Me, as well as the folks at Civic Makers, a volunteer-led initiative who are helping local councils solve big problems. First up, we'll be hearing from Elise Chan and Dominic Wilkowski, two of the amazing people involved in the Design System AU collective.
My name's Elise. I'm a developer. I've been working in the industry for 10 years. I'm helping with the Design System AU project in a foundational way, and we're trying to get the community together. I'm currently working with the Department of Agriculture on the export services platform.
Hi, my name is Dominic. I work in Thinkmill as an engineering manager. I was involved in creating the design system for the government when it was first created, and am now following Elise to build the design system in the community under the new direction of Design System AU.
For those that don't know, can you explain what a design system is and why it's important?
This is a question that we are being asked in many different ways. I'm very fortunate to have been involved in a bunch of design systems in the past, all the way from smaller things like the Westpac Gel, all the way to Shopify's Polaris and Atlassian's Atlas Kit. Design systems are often more of an organizational structure, but many people talk about it in a component library kind of way. So yes, there is a component library part of it. So we talk about reusable components like Lego blocks that we can use to build something that allow us to create more things faster in a more consistent way. But there's a lot more to it. There's specifically more in there when it comes to curation and design and systemizing how we speak to our customers or our consumers. And that's really important. It also allows us to increase the quality of the things that we're building, including things like accessibility, something that is often overlooked or not overlooked, but we don't have enough time for in the end. So we get to increase the quality of our outcome. And last but not least, it is helping us define our front end systems. Like, how do we build things for the consumer that they're actually going to see? What is our opinion about what frameworks and all the sort of things that lots of people have lots of opinions about? So a design system is trying to unify this and trying to come up with a way to make it consistent throughout the company, the department, the agency, all that stuff.
Can you give us a bit of history on the Australian Government Design System?
was actually a collaboration of a bunch of different departments that came together because they wanted to create something that is easier to use and also share practices and code and design amongst each other so that ultimately for the taxpayers, the experience of going to a government service is unified and easier to grasp and easier to understand. I was fortunate enough then to be working in the DTA. I was the one who was hired literally for building a design system. When we got to actually set up a team for this, we took all those people that have been interested and active in the space from the federal government and met with and talked to them about what we should do and how it should work. And they gave incredible support. In one meeting, they actually managed to point out that this is probably the first time in Australian history that this many departments have met and collaborated on the same project. And once we've created the design system, there was a lot of excitement. One of the things that our research very much in the beginning showed us is that it cannot be owned by a specific agency or department because there's too much politics involved. So we created a brand called GOLD, which is the Government Open Language for Design, that was meant to live in the middle between all the departments, sort of in the center, so that everyone can take ownership and everyone can build into it and help us do the thing. And it was very successful. Like, we were welcomed very warmly into the community of design systems worldwide. Ultimately, the DTA decided to change that branding to something else, but I believe we were onto something, and there was a lot of passion in the community that I think we still see today.
You've mentioned that the system was decommissioned. Can you give us a bit of context and how that led to the Design System AU Collective?
Not too long ago, in September, the DTA announced that they would no longer support the Australian Government Design System. And in their words, they were decommissioning the Australian Government Design System. And that was in combination with them decommissioning the cloud.gov.au service, which is hosting many of the websites that in government. That also meant that they would be removing the documentation site. The assumption was that the design system and the sort of like presence of it on the internet would disappear, and a lot of people were upset about this because the system is still widely popular and filling a void. And there is will in the community to continue supporting it. So there was a need to put forward an alternative based on the Australian Government Design System, which is now known as the GOLD Design System. This is the same design system, just with the difference of that is now being managed by the community instead of the DTA. Serendipitously, some of the folks that were still working on the design system at the DTA are also working on the GOLD design system. So, and that sort of speaks to the nature of the inclusivity of the system, that it is still relevant and useful, and people are wanting to be involved in it from all walks and all places of government in Australia. So that's the origin of Design System AU. Design System AU is a collective of designers, developers, accessibility experts, content people, marketing people, all others that can contribute to the GOLD design system. Eventually, these things need to be kept updated. For instance, the next JavaScript version is released and we need to update things, and new NPM packages are released and there's security vulnerabilities and all sorts of things. And all of these things, just like any open source project, need to be kept on top of. Now we have the chance to really be in control of these things and actively and proactively fix these things and make sure that websites all around are benefiting from these updates. Someone now has the autonomy to go in and fix an issue, to ship it, and then for any other consumer of that package or that dependency to benefit from that change. And that's the future that we'd sort of like to sort of see, like that the design system can continue to be the multiplier effect of people contributing to it, that the multiplier of benefit from it. We can guarantee the ongoing relevance of the system in the context of today.
Amazing. Can you talk a little bit about the community aspect and also how folks can contribute?
The design system AU has picked up the work from the DTA after it's been decommissioned, completely supported by all of its awesome contributors and people in the community who have rallied behind it. And we've also rebranded it back into the original gold brand to stay true to the research that we've done back then. So it's actually kind of exciting.
To continue with building gold and maintaining gold, we're looking for people power to help grow the platform and the community around gold. We want to ship code at Gold Design System. So we're on GitHub and you can jump on there and help us out. We're squashing bugs, fixing things, thinking about the future. But as well as that, we also want to make space for other capabilities than developers. And this involves the whole team. So we want designers, accessibility experts, everybody on the team to be involved. And in that sense, we're looking at how can we make gold better? What are the features that are missing? Are there features missing? Or how can we make the website better, or how can we be branded better? These are all open source project problems, and everyone's invited to get involved. Bring your capability, bring what you know, and offer what you know to the initiative, and let's do stuff. The best way to get involved is to join the Slack. So jump in there and, like, just let's start talking about things. We want to decide what to do next together. So we invite everybody to bring forward their ideas.
There's actually a partnership that some people started that gives you as an agency of the government or even as a private company the opportunity to chip in and help this effort and make the design system even better.
So what about for people who want to use the system for their projects?
Folks that want to get involved in using the system should just head to the website, gold.designsystemau.org, and get self-started. You can download components one at a time via NPM, or you can download a starter kit. There's links on the website. In the starter kit, you get the whole thing. And just get going. The advice is, get going. If you run into a problem or you feel like you're growing out of the system, maybe fork the code and, keep trying things in the code. Like, help us grow gold. When you come up with a great idea that you think is worth shipping back, then open a pull request or help us understand why that change is important to you. And let's get that integrated back into the source code so others can benefit from that great discovery that you've made. So yeah, but there's plenty of people, or there's so many people that are using gold for years and years and continue to, and for simple, medium, and even complex cases, and they can do that without running into these issues. Like, that's the beauty of this design system. It's like a very quality design system. And now that you know that there's support there, if something happens in the middle of your project and you're using the design system, the community is there just a stone's throw away to support you to figure out how to get your problem in front of you over the line. And that's the whole premise of the community and what we're trying to do. We're trying to have one big tech team, you know, or one big digital team. We're from many places in Australia, in government, even in private and public places. But together we're building this system and we're here for one another.
Sounds like the definition of civic tech to me. Thanks so much, Elise and Dom. Next, we'll be hearing from Kenneth Tsang, creator of COVID Near Me, about the innovative work that he's done with public data.
So my name's Ken Tsang. I'm the creator of COVID-19 Near Me, which is a COVID-19 exposure site app, and it's also got a vaccination clinic finder capability. I guess in terms of, you know, what I do on a day-to-day, I'm a geospatial software engineer, which basically means I specialize in making map-based applications and software.
For anyone not familiar, can you share with us what open data means? And if you can expand on that, why is it important?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, at its core, open data is about, you know, making data more freely available to the public. Governments and to some extent some companies have a lot of valuable data that's locked away. And in Australia and most Western societies, I guess, we have relatively robust freedom of information laws, which means we can get access to information. But the concept of open data is a bit more than that. It's actually data that's open and public by default, so you don't need to ask for the data. For data that makes sense, and it's data that's updated on a regular basis, and it's, you know, open and machine readable, so that people can analyze it in a meaningful way. So opening it up, I guess, it gives the public access to the data, allowing them to sort of innovate or come up with new ideas and use it in new ways. And some of these ideas, you know, might be things that government can't do, whether that's bureaucratic reasons, legal reasons, or resource constraints. So giving the public the ability to test and innovate with this data, it opens up a whole bunch of new possibilities for government and, I guess, also for private citizens.
Let's start from the very beginning of COVID-19 Near Me. For those who don't know, can you explain what it is and how you got started with it?
I mean, COVID-19 Near Me sort of came out of this problem I had, right? So back in December 2020 in New South Wales, we had the what we call the Northern Beaches outbreak. And the New South Wales Health's response to that was, we'll start publishing this massive list of exposure sites, and just kept growing day after day because there were more and more exposure sites being added. And it became really hard to keep on top of or checking the list because it grew so long, and there wasn't really an easy way to check what's new, what's just been added. It's sort of this massive list that just grows and grows. So what I thought I'd do was create an app where not only can you see where the exposure sites are on a map, but you can check them off one by one. So you can say, no, I haven't been to this location, and it'll just mark it as dismissed, and it'll never annoy you again. So what will happen over time is you'll only see the new and updated alerts, and then you can just keep on top of those. And over time, that's sort of grown. You know, it started off just with New South Wales, then moved over to Victoria when they had their outbreaks, and then, you know, now I have all of the states, whenever they have, you know, positive cases with exposure sites, we'll get them added. Also have New Zealand, who also provide data. So that's the crux of it.
So what does COVID-19 Near Me do that other platforms don't do?
The two key features that COVID-19 Near Me does that I guess the official government ones don't is this checklist functionality. So providing you with the ability to go, yeah, I haven't been to this location. Don't tell me about this location again, because, you know, it's not relevant to me. And then only seeing the updates. So that's not really a feature that's been available to the government ones, because it's sort of a static website with a table. Over time, the official government ones, especially for, you know, New South Wales and Victoria, who have had, you know, more substantial outbreaks, they've evolved it over time so that you can sort tables by when a location was last updated, so you can more easily identify which ones were added. But initially, you know, that wasn't really a feature. The other thing is a map. So it depends on the person, but some people prefer seeing this location data on a map because it might make more sense to them. Oh, yeah, these are the points that are near my house. I'll focus more on that. So, you know, it's sort of this evolution over time of me building something and then maybe government following shortly after or maybe a bit longer. But, you know, it happens, you know, to just sort of wait for them to sort of catch up to what the public expects of these government features, I guess. You know, it's this problem of, you know, government needing to move fast because this is, you know, time critical stuff, right? And they don't necessarily have the time and resources to put in to meet those demands immediately. It might happen over time, but yeah, I mean, their priority is notifying the public. So it's understandable for them to prioritize that first and then come back and refine it later.
You mentioned that you developed COVID-19 Year Me in December of 2020. Fast forward to September of 2021, you've also developed a vaccine booking system as part of it. Why is that?
I guess we all sort of faced the problem of not being able to find vaccine clinic availabilities nearby or found it challenging to do so, especially earlier on when, you know, vaccine supply was quite constrained. So what I thought was I'd build a system which allowed us to check the availability of a larger selection of vaccine providers. So the government through Health Direct actually provides a vaccine sort of eligibility checker and also a vaccine clinic finder at the end of it. And that's been really good at identifying which locations have vaccine clinics. But because of the way the rollout is sort of structured, it's sort of diversifying the providers. You know, you can go to a pharmacy, you can go to a GP clinic, you can go to a state-run clinic. There's all these different options. And each of these different clinics might run a different booking system. There's the big few, which are, you know, which cover maybe the majority of clinics. But Health Direct hasn't been able to connect to a large number of these booking providers, like pharmacy providers, for example. So it's really hard to find availabilities through the official site because all it tells you is, yeah, this clinic, they've ordered some vaccines, but we don't know whether there's still booking available. So thinking there was, I can pull in the list of clinics. I can source it from, you know, whether that's the pharmacy guild, from pharmacies directly, from the official vaccine finder. But not only that, but also add my own booking, clinic booking checker, basically, to check availability for each of these different systems. I don't have coverage for all of them, but I've been able to add more than what the government's been able to do in their time and sort of make it easier for people to discover vaccine clinics that are close to them.
Given that the reporting on COVID is changing and our circumstances are changing, what are the next steps for COVID-19 Near Me?
Yeah. So for the exposure sites, on a sort of state-by-state basis, I've been archiving the data. So New South Wales and Victoria, they've basically said they're not publishing anything new anymore. So, you know, I've put a little label there to say we're not publishing anything new anymore, to check your Service New South Wales or Service Victoria app, because that's where the alerts will be coming from. They're going to contact you directly. We'll keep the data there for historical purposes for people to go and, you know, for research into future. But over time, I'm expecting all states to sort of reach that. For the vaccine clinic side of things, boosters are becoming more of a thing, I think. So that's probably going to be sticking around for a little while longer. And I think I'll be making some changes soon to make it easier to find clinics which are accepting booster shots. The other thing with COVID-19 EME is I'm pulling in the vaccination statistics. So, you know, the federal government's responsible for the vaccine rollout in that regard. And they publish statistics as PDF files every day, right? That's probably still going to continue. There's a process to try and scrape that data from the PDF and make it into a machine-readable process. And there's a few sites relying on that information, so that's probably sticking around for a while longer as well, at least until we get probably our, you know, First Nations vaccination rate up and probably until we get significant booster coverage. But we'll keep an eye on it.
And that's all the questions I had for COVID-19 Near Me. I did also notice, though, that you've started other open data projects like something called AnyTrip. Can you tell us more about those?
Yeah, I mean, any trip sort of came out of when Transport for New South Wales decided to release their public transport data as open data. So before that, they gave timetables out, but not the real-time stuff. And as soon as they made that open data, I jumped onto it and I was like, you know what I want? I want a map that shows where every single vehicle is. I'm a bit of a transport geek, I guess you can call it. So, yeah, that's sort of where it started. And over time, I built more and more of it. And, you know, it's now, you know, a fully fledged transport app. You can download it on your phone. It's a web app as well. I think I find a lot of my projects come out of either personal interest or sort of problems that I face myself. So the vaccine stuff or, you know, exposure sites lists being too long. Any trip's more of a, you know, I want to see where all the public transport services are. Less a problem, more of an interest thing. But yeah, I guess that's where the majority of my project ideas come from.
You seem super passionate about making use of open data to build things for the public good. How can people get more involved with such open data projects?
Yeah, I mean, there's communities to or forums to do that in. You know, there's obviously hackathons, which are less of a thing during the pandemic or more virtual. So they're probably a good place to get exposure or to understand or get to know other people who are also in the space. There's also, you know, depending on a government basis, there's programs to innovate with data. So I'm thinking, you know, Transport for New South Wales, open data again, but there's other equivalents in other states, not just transport. They give you the opportunity to solve problems for government. So I'm thinking, like, for example, Victoria has this civic program where basically, you know, it's, you know, citizen tech projects for Victoria, and they come up with problem statements, and then they sort of ask the community for proposals for projects. I think giving it a go, if you find a gap in what the government offers and there's no sort of incentive or program to guide you to that, don't be afraid to try and make something if the data's there. As I said earlier, you know, a lot of my ideas come from solving problems I face myself or my own interests. You might have similar projects or sort of interests yourselves. Another thing to keep in mind is probably that civic tech is sort of this partnership between government and individuals. It's quite easy for us to criticize government for not giving us, you know, the perfect data set, open data. But I think it's really a case of show, not tell, because it's a partnership, right? So if you can show what can be achieved by releasing open data and the benefits of it, governments and ultimately it's the decision makers in government, they're more willing to open up the data and make it easier for future projects. So that's just something to keep in mind, I guess.
And for any of our listeners out there who want to kick off their own civic tech projects, what advice can you give them?
Have a go and see how it lands, because there's always going to be people who give you feedback. And you can take that feedback on board to innovate and try new things. I think what I mentioned earlier about it being a partnership is also pretty important, right? Because one of the things that we fall into as a community tends to be that we are too negative and sort of disincentivize or end up discouraging governments from publishing the data. So I don't know, if you want to kick off your own project, maybe have a look and see what's available in terms of data out there. See if there's a problem that you want to solve that the data offers. And I think the show not tell part, meaning, you know, develop something and then go, oh, but it'd be great or even better if this other data was available. Government, please give me this data. I think that is a better approach at moving this whole sort of civic tech thing forward.
Thanks, Ken. Next, we'll be hearing from Aina and Ching, two of the leads in the Civic Makers project, who are helping council solve some big problems.
My name is Aina, and I'm a UX designer. I'm also the design lead with Civic Makers.
My name is Ching. I am one of the dev leads as part of Civic Makers.
Can you tell us what Civic Makers is?
It's a group of people who are passionate about tackling, like, civic issues, whatever that is.
We have people from all walks of life joining Civic Makers. I guess only more recently with Civic Makers, we've had more techies and more designers joining us. But I think we have an open door policy as long as you have the interest and the willingness and the keenness to learn and help. Yeah, the door is freely open for anyone to join.
And what's the project that you're currently working on?
So the current project that we're working on is a travel emissions calculator. And we are fortunate enough to be working with a council. We're focusing on the staff's travel emission.
The thing with making, I think I would best describe it as part survey, part tool. What we've done is we've created this survey for the council to send out to the council workers, basically the employees of the council. The kinds of questions that we have in the survey currently are designed in a way to elicit their commute patterns so that we can use that the information from like their responses to approximate their travel emissions. So that's the second part of, I guess, this project. There's a calculator component based on the responses that we have from the respondents. We'll use that to calculate the travel emissions.
Yeah, so the idea of the emissions calculator is to help council inform any improvements or initiatives that they want to do around climate change. Like, so the staff will all, you know, input how they travel, and then council then gets a report of an overview of how the staff travel to work, the sort of transport that they use and the distance, and like and as well we're asking, is there anything that would incentivize them to choose a more climate-friendly travel option, and then we pass that on to council, and council can then use that information to inform what they want to do next. And I think the council at the moment is doing a lot of work around like climate change initiatives within the council itself, but also internally with their staff. This first round that we'll do will be like the base information, and in 6 months or 1 year we'll do it again, and hopefully in between they would have implemented any kind of changes based on that first lot of data, and then we measure it again and see how has it improved, has it got worse, are there new initiatives, how did that work.
Amazing. So how did you decide on this project?
I think how this got started was, I think initially, the scope was actually a little bit broader. We eventually settled on an idea to do something for council. We were always umming and ahhing between two different camps. Like, do we want to do something more local? That we can see like impact on a shorter scale, or do we want to do something like on the broader scale, but we may not see any impact from the app or the tool that we make. Yeah, definitely we spent probably a year and a bit in kind of like discovery phase. So it took a while, but it was fun.
You know, we did lots of research, right? We spoke to people, we had some kind of problem statements that were like, oh, this is something that people are passionate about. You know, we had a few ideas and we tested that with like actual people. We went out and we asked people about their thoughts and behaviors around the problems that we were thinking to address. And then after speaking to a lot of people, there was this sense that like some people feel like they can't make the change, so like they're not very confident with their role in like how they can affect climate change. But then there's the other side of like going to the government where they have maybe they're able to reach more people, and in the end, yeah, that's kind of where we went to go. You know, do we create change like on an individual level, or is there a better way to do that? And we looked at federal, state government, and then local council, and local council was that kind of ideal bridge, and I guess which is what they are, right? And that's kind of what we felt that working with a local council would allow us to create that kind of maybe ideal level of change.
Can you tell us why initiatives like Civic Makers are important?
Getting involved in the community project is another way for me to learn new skills and form new bonds, form new connections. I do want a way to give back to the community in some way with all the experience I've gained from working as a software developer.
I've been involved in kind of various communities for a while, and I've seen the power of communities to, I guess, to create change. Yeah, I love that sense of community, like working with people who are really passionate about what they're doing, and want to give back and with the skills and train other people as well. Like, it's not just about us; it's about helping people who are new to the industry. So, for example, like, you know, our current team, we've had people just jumped on the development train or the design train, and we get to work with them. They're really amazing, and they give us a new perspective to things as well. Sometimes, you know, it's easy to, you know, and we all do this, to go like, something's not working, that's not great. But then you kind of just, I don't really have the time to deal with it. I have like a lot of my own problems in my brain. And so, like, if there are a group of people who have that capacity and want to do something about it, there are groups like Civic Makers who do that.
How can people get involved in Civic Makers?
Join the Code for Australia Slack group. Find the climate change Civic Makers, but then also tell us how you want to contribute and what interests you, so that we can help you kind of figure out where you fit. You know how Ching said that we're an open door, that, like, you know, even though we're in the middle of a project, doesn't mean that you have to wait for us to finish a project to join. Like, jump on our next meeting. Like, we always welcome new people. Like, even if you no idea what's happening, like, come and say hello anyway.
Just sign up, just do it. Yeah.
A huge thank you to all of our wonderful guests, Elise, Dom, Ken, Ching and Ina. We're always floored at the amazing work that the folks in the Civic Tech universe are accomplishing. And we hope that this episode's highlighted some of that awesome work and given you some inspiration to start your own project. We'd also like to thank all the other folks that have been guests on our podcast this year, as well as Inda Abraham and Nigel Moyes for our logo design, Daniel Simo for composing our music, and most importantly, all of you. Thanks for listening, subscribing, and sending lovely messages of support. We hope you have a restful holiday.